I am the Martian ambassador. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
You know, that's just like your opinion, man.
It's time for Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of d-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts Robin.
Hello.
And TK.
Hello.
The final countdown continues as we work towards the conclusion of Shouts from the Back Row. That's right. In case you haven't heard, we are bringing this podcast to a close at the end of this month after 7 years of movie discussion. There are only two more episodes left after this one. It's kind of hard to believe. And since we're wrapping up the show, we thought it might be fun to take a look at our pantheon of movies, an idea that I totally stole from the Film Spotting podcast. We created the Pantheon a few years into the podcast because we found that there were certain movies that just kept coming up again and again in our discussions. These were the movies that were the measuring stick for the rest of cinema, the gold standards, and, of course, our favorite films. The Pantheon grew and changed a bit over the years, and while it was always part of the conversation, our rule was that we could never include these movies on any of our lists of favorites because it would just be the same movies over and over again. So, on this episode, we're going to go back into the Pantheon, and we're actually going to dedicate some discussion to our all-time favorites. And to do this, we have each chosen one of our own personal Pantheon picks, one of our favorite films to discuss. We've all watched all of our movies, and now we're going to talk about them. Right after this. This is about the time where we'd usually do the batshit crazy movie countdown, but of course, since we've decided to draw the podcast to a close, we're not actually going to be able to see, in fact, any of the films that are on this year's batshit crazy movie countdown. But I'm just going to do a quick recap here. This all started with Jupiter Ascending. Back in 2014, when I arbitrarily decided to count down the days until the release of a movie that I thought would be the most insane of the year. And I don't know if it was, in fact, the most insane movie of that year, but it was just on, like, I kept bringing it up so often that we had to award it most batshit crazy movie of 2014. And to be fair, it is pretty batshit crazy. Our 2015 winner was The Lobster, picked by TK. Our 2016 winner blindsided us all. It was like a late nominee, but it was Swiss Army Man. And this year we had three potential batshit crazy movies of 2017. I chose Bright, the Max Landis written Will Smith, Joel Edgerton buddy cop movie, but like mixed with fantasy. It's a buddy cop movie between a human and an orc in a land of fairies and elves and all that. It, basically Shadowrun. It's like it's Lethal Weapon meets Shadowrun. It's coming out in December. Robin nominated Best Friends, the new film starring Tommy Wiseau and Greg Sestero, where Tommy Wiseau is a mortician, like an undertaker, who is stealing, he's using dead bodies to smuggle gold, I guess, or maybe he's like stealing gold from their teeth. I'm not entirely sure, but he picks up Greg Sestero, who's a hitchhiker, and the two of them go on like a crazy road trip, I guess. It does look nuts. I gotta give you that one, Robin. I don't know if it's come out in wide release yet, but I don't think any of us have had a chance to see it.
And no, then, I don't think it's out. But on the other hand, I'm hearing a lot of buzz about The Disaster Artist starring James Franco as Tommy Wiseau. That a lot of people think it's going to be one of the best films of this year.
The trailer looks pretty hilarious, and apparently Tommy Wiseau himself has said he likes it 99.9%. So there's
that's good.
There's like a tiny little thing that he doesn't like. And then TK's submission for Batshit Crazy Movie of 2017 was The Killing of a Sacred Deer. And this is the movie, this is the reason that I bring up our countdown again before we finish off the podcast. And that's because today I watched the trailer for The Killing of a Sacred Deer. And this is the new film by Yorgos Lanthimos, who did The Lobster, our 2015 winner. And also he did Dogtooth, which is a pretty insane movie. I don't know if I'd call it batshit crazy, but it is like dark and twisted for sure. And I gotta say, from the trailer of The Killing of a Sacred Deer, I don't think this is going to be the batshit crazy movie of the year. I think it looks really good and like a really scary psychological thriller, really, you know, dark and twisted, but I don't think it's going to be like batshit insane. And we've also seen the trailer for Bright, and I, you know, it is pretty crazy in a very Jupiter ascending way, but my money is on Best Friends. Of these three movies, I think Best Friends is probably going to run away with the most batshit crazy movie of 2017. Do you guys have any other thoughts on the countdown? We're probably not going to revisit this before the conclusion of the podcast series, unless somehow one of us sees one of these movies.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, I have no idea when Best Friends is coming out, so I don't think we'll see it by the end. But I was looking forward to talking about that one, since Tommy Wiseau has not made a movie or appeared in a movie in God knows how long. But I thought it was kind of appropriate, though, that last year our batshit crazy movie of the year also wound up being the best movie of the year, number one on our list for two out of the three of us. So it's kind of appropriate that our last one that got completed intersected with our best of list for the year.
Yeah, and you know, I have to say, with the exception of Jupiter Ascending, I think we've actually, these batshit crazy movies have turned out to be good, too. Like, The Lobster, I was kind of, you know, I was kind of divided on The Lobster. There were some things that I really liked and some things that I really didn't like, but it was definitely one of the most interesting and creative movies of that year, and for all that it was crazy, it was probably one of the best films, too. TK, do you have any thoughts on the batshit crazy movie countdown? This all really started because you hated Jupiter Ascending. I kind of started it to tease you as we counted down to go see that movie.
God, that film was bad. Like, are you just talking about in general or like our choices from this year?
Either or. I mean, we're wrapping up the podcast, so yeah. This is probably going to be the last that we talk about the batshit crazy movie countdown.
I think it's been fun to kind of like, because I've watched films that I don't ever think I would normally watch, like Swiss Army Man or things like that. But it's a kind of a fun experiment. I'm very glad I went with a lot. And I haven't seen the trailer for Killing of a Sacred Deer, and it kind of looks at that into something like that.
Yeah, I'm going to send you both of those trailers once we're done recording this, because they both look like really cool movies. Bright looks like a really fun, wacky movie, and then Killing of a Sacred Deer looks really scary and creepy.
But it's that sort of films that I think are kind of cool to see slip into our choices and things like that. So it's I'm still going to watch these films when we're done recording, and I'm probably going to start seeking out some weirder stuff as time goes on.
Yeah, it's a great point. For all that these are batshit crazy movies, it has definitely like broadened our horizons a bit, where now we sort of actively keep an eye out for the really crazy movies of any given year, because we could then talk about them in this little segment. So, batshit crazy movie countdown. I guess maybe we will talk about it a little bit more after TK watches the trailers for Bright and Killing of a Sacred Deer. And also, I do want to mention that Geostorm was sort of like an honorable mention among the nominees, because it just sounds so ridiculous, and it's coming out this year. I've seen the trailer for it, and I have to say, it looks less ridiculous than I was hoping. Like, it looks just like another sort of Dean Devlin, big, like, large-scale disaster movie with lots of landmarks crashing into other landmarks. So that one's probably going to end up more stupid than batshit crazy, but I still get a good laugh over the plot summary. So we like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. And this is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and just about everything else we've been doing. TK, have you been up to much since last week?
The only things I've caught up with Game of Thrones and Rick and Morty. I'm two episodes behind on Preacher. I really enjoyed this week's episode because it was a lot of the setup. It felt like a gang getting back together start, and I'm very interested to see where the series goes. And I liked Rick and Morty this. I liked the Rick and Morty episode. I wasn't as impressed as seemingly a lot of other people were with Pickle Rick. So I think this one was more interesting. I also didn't have a B storyline. I thought that was kind of fun, so we stayed with the main characters for the whole time.
Hang on. I got to stop you right there. You didn't like the Pickle Rick episode?
I never said I didn't like the Pickle Rick episode. I just don't think it's their best episode, which I'm seeing a lot of people are claiming so online.
Really? Like the best episode of the whole series?
Well, it's up in the higher echelons for some people, apparently. It is just not online.
I think the Pickle Rick episode is the best episode of this season so far, but I wouldn't put it among the top tier episodes.
All right, then there we have it, I guess.
Well, yes, there we have it. Yes, my word is final, TK. There you go. No.
No, I just don't have anything else to add about it. It's like I enjoyed it, but just, I don't know.
Which episode, which was the most recent episode that you've seen of Game of Thrones?
The one that drops Sunday.
What are we, some kind of Suicide Squad?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I thought that was nice.
Okay, so just on the topic of Game of Thrones, this Sunday's upcoming episode 6 of season 7, it got accidentally aired in Spain on HBO. They aired an episode early by accident in Spain, and so it's all over the internet, of course. And I fully admit that I watched the leaked episode. This one's on you, HBO. This isn't Pirates. This is on you. And I gotta say, it was so bad. It's really terrible. I'm not gonna spoil anything, but be warned. This is a... I'm so unimpressed. I was really mad. Really mad. This episode made me really mad. I'll say this. I'll say very minor spoilers for Game of Thrones. This is not gonna be like jump down my throat spoilers. But at the end of last week's episode, it ended with a squad of characters who we are all invested in going north of the wall on a suicide mission, basically. And the squad is entirely made up of characters we like. People like Jon Snow, Jorah Mormont, the Hound, etc., etc. So, TK, how would you feel if I told you that squad, unbeknownst to us, also contains like 5 or 6 random dudes who are just there to die?
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
It surprised the hell out of me because they were not mentioned until they start dying in this episode. I'm watching this episode, something bad's about to happen to all these characters that I know and love, and then the camera pans over and there's some rando just standing there, and Caitlin and I both go, "Who's that asshole?" And then he dies. Decisions like that have really pissed me off in watching episode 6. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts, but that way, oh, I'm so mad at it. I won't spoil anything more than that, though. Robin, what have you been up to?
I've seen a couple new movies this week. I saw Kathryn Bigelow's new film, Detroit, which is also written by Mark Boal. The two of them worked together on The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. And this was a really good movie overall. It came out at the 50th anniversary of the Detroit 1967 race riots. And it is kind of creepy to watch it and realize that there's so much stuff in this film that's still very timely today. I think the timing for the release of it is perfect since there's still a lot of racial tension going on in the U.S., particularly between the police and black minorities and stuff. So watching this movie, you could feel like you were watching this today and not in 1967, and not a lot would be different. But it's a very like well shot, like documentary style, very intense movie. The first act sets all the characters up, gives the historical context of the riot. I think overall, the second act overall is the strongest section of the film, because most of it takes place in this one isolated, cramped motel where the cops think that someone has fired a sniper shot at them, even though it was kind of a practical joke gone wrong. And they're questioning and interrogating all these young black men one by one, trying to figure out who was at the bottom of it. It's probably some of the most intense stuff that I've seen in a movie this year. Like, it's almost very difficult to watch because of how like brutal and realistic it is. I think the standout performance in this film is by Will Poulter, who plays a racist police officer. He's like really intense, which is pretty cool to see, because he's a guy who started off as kind of a child actor, and now here he is playing this like evil villain, and he's really effective in the role. I do think that the third act of the movie doesn't really live up to the second. Once the whole incident at the motel is over and they're kind of dealing with the aftermath and the trial and legalities of it, it's very well done, but it doesn't really have the same punch as the second act does, because they're just kind of like trying to resolve the story, but it doesn't have the same urgency for it. But I definitely would recommend it overall, because Catherine Bigelow, like always, does a magnificent job at these stories, at these realistic, gritty, documentary-like stories. And this one is no exception. And like I said, watching it today, it feels like nothing has changed in the past 50 years of the U.S. So I think this movie is going to have a lot of staying power.
Do you think it's
you
a
had a
strong...
chance to see it yet?
Oh, sorry, no, I haven't. Do you think it's a strong contender for Oscar season?
I think so. Like, I don't think it has done that well at the box office, but it seems like the type of movie that the Academy would recognize, and it also would be kind of good for PR to nominate this like timely drama about like race riots and racist police officers. So we'll see if the buzz continues, because I know they love Catherine Bigelow's films, so I could see this one getting a lot of nominations when it comes next year.
I really want to see.
It's kind of weird.
No, sorry, go ahead.
It is kind of weird that it's a summer movie, because it doesn't feel like a summer blockbuster, but I guess they did it because they wanted to release it as the same week as the 50th anniversary of when the riots took place.
I really want to see it, but like Zero Dark Thirty especially, it's not a comfortable movie to sit through. It's one of those films, another film like this, not directed by Catherine Bigelow, is Beasts of No Nation, where they are these important films that are really well made. It sounds like Detroit is a really well made movie, but it's very hard for me to be in the mood to watch them. And the reason I ask if you think it's going to be a good Oscar contender is because that's the season when I usually end up watching these harder dramatic films, because they always end up nominated for Best Picture. So I fully intend to watch Detroit at some point, and it's kind of my hope that it gets a nomination, because it sounds like the kind of film that would deserve it, and at the same time, it would give me a really good excuse to watch it, and, you know, other than it just being a good movie that I should probably watch.
Yes, it does feel like the type of movie you would watch in December and or January around Oscar time to prepare for it. It is kind of weird watching this in summer blockbuster season, but it's definitely worthwhile. And another movie I saw, I told this story last year, but I tried to go see this movie in a theater, but the projector wound up breaking, so I got free passes to see something else. So I just kind of like walked into a screening of Bad Santa 2 instead, because I had nothing better to do. And but I still haven't gotten around to seeing the movie till now. And that's the movie Allied, the World War II movie starring Brad Pitt, Marion Cotillard, and directed by Robert Zemeckis. And I got to say, definitely not worth the wait. It's pretty weak. I think the biggest... Robert Zemeckis is kind of notorious for this, how apparently he likes it when like all the key points in his movies are shown in the trailer. Because I know, I think the most infamous example of this is Castaway, where they actually showed scenes of Tom Hanks off the island, like near the end. So they pretty much give away whether he survives or not. And I know his trailer for What Lies Beneath, like pretty much gave away that Harrison Ford was the villain. So apparently Robert Zemeckis likes this. And that kind of happens here, because the big hook in the trailer is Brad Pitt being told, your wife is probably a spy working for the Nazis. And when you're watching the movie, it kind of took me by surprise that this moment, the movie was literally half over before they had this revelation. Like, the first half is like setting up the relationship between Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard. And I guess it's supposed to take you by complete surprise halfway through when they reveal that, oh my God, she might be a Nazi spy. But if you've seen the trailer, you already know that's going to happen. And the trailer kind of shows from beginning to end how the story progresses. There are really no big surprises, and it just kind of sputters to a weak conclusion. So I can kind of see why this movie just kind of faded from obscurity when it was released in the winter, in spite of its major cast and this A-list director, because it's really, really forgettable. I might have liked it better if the trailer hadn't spoiled anything, but pretty much not worth the time, because it just feels like a movie. It feels lazy. That's the problem. Like, they weren't even trying. I know Robert Zemeckis is capable of so much better, and I guess the two actors are okay, but it just doesn't go anywhere interesting. It's on Netflix now, but I would be inclined to skip it unless you've got nothing better to do but watch it.
I had, like, completely forgotten about this. That's how little of an impact this movie ended up having, because I remember it now. And I do remember those trailers, which apparently give away everything. But yeah, I'd forgotten about it otherwise.
Yeah, that pretty much says a lot. That I remember when it came out, I'm thinking, oh, this looks like an Oscar bait film. But it didn't get any awards recognition, kind of bombed at the box office, and that was it. And here we are 9 months later, and nobody even remembers it. So I think that says it all.
So which is better, Allied or Bad Santa 2?
Bad Santa 2, surprisingly. Not like it was good, but I can still at least remember minor parts of it, like, several months later. But I don't think I'm going to remember anything about Allied by next week. So I actually made the right decision seeing Bad Santa 2 that night several months ago. So how do you like that?
Wow. That really says something.
It's true, yes. And I also wanted to mention something about The Trail Went Cold. Another Robin is Famous story. A couple of weeks ago, this other podcast I know called The History Dweebs, they have this big discussion group where, like, everyone, all the podcast listeners are this one big family. They have these really close relationships. And unfortunately, one of their listeners was killed in a car accident suddenly a few weeks ago. So they decided to hold a fundraiser on GoFundMe to raise money for his family. And what they did is they invited a bunch of the other podcasters to participate in it. And for a certain time in a night, they were going to have an auction where you could bid to get a Skype call with your favorite podcaster. And there were something like 20, 25 podcasters overall, and they raised over $4,000. But I was part of it, and people actually bid on me. And there were quite a few bidders. And the winning one, a girl named Radica from California, she bid $40 to get a Skype call from me. So I actually had a Skype call with her this week. She's like a huge fan of the podcast, and was very thankful to, like, talk to me and pick my brain about certain true crimes. And it's just so surreal, man, that someone would pay money to want to speak to me over the over Skype. But it's the wonderful thing about being a podcaster is that you can talk to fans all the way out there in California who just kind of geek out over you. And I even made her night by closing off the phone call by saying, after that, the trail went cold. So pretty exciting time right now. I should mention, while we're on the subject of discussion groups, I should mention that The Trail Went Cold also has its own discussion group now on Facebook. So if you want to talk to me or have more in-depth conversations about the cases featured on the podcast or just true crime in general, you can go ahead and join it. And I'm also holding a contest right now. It ends this coming Saturday at midnight, where you can win a chance to do the voiceover narration for the opening of the podcast on a future episode and actually let the whole world hear you say, after that, the trail went cold. And I've had a whole bunch of entries since I announced it last week. So pretty exciting. The podcast is going into bigger places, and I hope to be involved in more contests like this as well, where people will bid money to speak to me.
And we get it for free. Aw, yeah. Now that right there, that's the biggest perk of this podcast.
It's true, yes. I mean, if we were going to continue on, you would have to pay me $40 per
episode.
Oh,
no.
So, good thing we're ending right now. But no, yeah, you guys have had 7 years for free, so that's pretty cool that I'm moving up.
Oh, he's so humbled. The fame is not going to Robin's head whatsoever.
No, not at all. No. So yes, I also released a new episode this week, per usual, if you want to listen to it. And like I said, just go to our Facebook page and click on the Facebook discussion group, and I'll approve your join, and we can chat about true crime. And yeah, that's about all I've been up to.
Since our last episode, I've done a little bit of stuff. I watched Spider-Man Homecoming again because Caitlin hadn't seen it. So we rewatched it. And, you know, rewatching it, my opinion of this went up a little bit. It is a very enjoyable film. It's actually pretty rare these days that I see, like, new releases multiple times in the theater in a row. You know, I go and I see it in the theater, and then I usually don't watch it again until it's out on video in some form. So seeing Spider-Man Homecoming twice in a row was a rare experience for me these days, but it was pretty enjoyable, and there were some things that I appreciated about it even more on the second time. Like, I really like that Parker's best friend is this big fat guy, but they make no fat jokes. You know, in a lesser movie, they'd make a whole lot of fat jokes about that kid, but they don't bother. I like that. I really like Marissa Tomei. I paid more attention to her performance. And I like how the film ends and what that means for her relationship with Peter. Just a lot of little details like that I appreciated more on a second viewing, raised up my opinion of this film. So yeah, this is definitely the best Spider-Man film, I think. Really fun, some good action. But as I said on last show, it also has fairly low stakes as far as the villain, and that works. That makes them feel more personal than just yet another blue beam of light shooting up into the sky, as tends to happen so often in superhero movies. So yeah, more endorsement for Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yep, I totally agree. I was not looking forward to seeing this at all because I was so sick of Spider-Man, but it was such a pleasant surprise and different than your average superhero movie, and I'd gladly see more of them with Tom Holland in the role.
And I can't remember if I've mentioned this, but this podcast is actually one degree of separation away from Spider-Man Homecoming director John Watts, because I did some work on his horror film Clown that was produced by Eli Roth a couple of years ago when they shot it in Ottawa. So there you go. I guess I never met the guy in person because I was just doing post-production stuff, but I have worked on a film from the director of the new Spider-Man. Yay. That's
cool. I'd completely forgotten that he was the director of Clown, because I still have yet to see Clown, but it's great to see that he's gone on to such big things and actually did a phenomenal job.
Yeah, it was just like a couple of years from doing like a funny independent horror film like Clown to doing Spider-Man. I think a similar thing happened to John Watts that happened to people like Gareth Edwards or Colin Trevorrow, where they do an independent film that does okay. It at least gets some attention. In John Watts's case, it wasn't Clown. It was actually the film Cop Car with Kevin Bacon. And then the studios snap them up and immediately give them a franchise film to direct because they're new and the studio can still have a lot of control, but it also gives them a great opportunity to cut their teeth on like a major blockbuster. Some of them work, some of them don't, but I think Spider-Man Homecoming worked really well, and that we're going to see so much more of John Watts soon. I haven't seen Cop Car. Have either of you guys seen Cop Car?
No, I haven't.
Gotta watch that movie. I've heard it's really good. And the other thing that I've been up to is I've been playing the Dishonored video games. During the summer Steam sale, I bought Dishonored 2, which came out fairly recently. And I was a very big fan of the first Dishonored when it was released, I believe, in 2012. So I decided I was going to replay Dishonored and then start playing through Dishonored 2. Do them back to back. And so I finished Dishonored, and I'm a few chapters into Dishonored 2. And first I'll talk about Dishonored. This is a really awesome game. I had forgotten how much I like this game, where it's the world of the game, for starters, is this very cool, surreal, semi-steampunk, semi-magical world. It's kind of like Victorian London, but they're like everything's run on whale oil, and it's kind of like electricity punk as well as steampunk. You play the disgraced bodyguard of an empress, sworn to protect the empress's daughter, but you fail when these like weird assassins show up and kill the empress and kidnap the daughter. So now you're on the run, you are dishonored, and you have to prove your innocence while simultaneously getting the empress's daughter back. It's awesome. Really fun gameplay. You get to choose your approach to all of the levels. So you can be super stealthy and sneaky and just hide and sneak past everyone undetected. Or you, if you want, you can go in guns blazing and, you know, really tear up the place action movie style. Or you can do some combination of things, which is usually what I do, where I try to be sneaky, but if a guy catches me, I ruthlessly slit his throat or, you know, do some cool martial arts or something. So the world is great, the gameplay is great, and something I had forgotten is that the voice cast for Dishonored is fantastic. The Empress's daughter is voiced by Chloe Grace Moretz. Your character is, of course, silent, but you team up with these rebels who believe that you're innocent, and the voice of the lead of the rebels is John Slattery of Mad Men, and he's Howard Stark, he's the old Howard Stark. Roger Sterling, of course. The rebels have among them an inventor guy who's kind of like Q, you know, he gives you all your gadgets, and I recognized his voice as Brad Dourif. So it was pretty cool to realize that this game I played years ago actually has this all-star voice cast in it. And it's super fun. And then I've started in on Dishonored 2, and honestly, it just feels like a continuation of the story. So far, the game hasn't really done anything new with the gameplay elements, and frankly, that's totally fine by me. The gameplay elements are top-notch. The world of the game still feels similar, but there are like little advances around the edges. So it feels a little bit different, but very samey as well. And again, not a complaint. They got that right the first time around. The graphics are vastly improved and look fantastic. And they are already presenting me with the inspiration to do another playthrough when I'm done my first one, because early on in the game, you get to decide if you want to continue playing as Corvo, the main character from the first game, or if you want to play as the now grown-up Emily, who is the Empress, who you saved, and play as her instead. And it seems like the content, like the character, what the characters say to you, changes based on who you're playing. So I'll probably end up playing through this game at least once more just to see all the additional content. Big recommendation on both these games. Like, I don't think they're the best games ever made, but they are so very entertaining. TK, have you played Dishonored? This seems like the kind of game you would love.
Yeah, no, I did play the first Dishonored, but I haven't had a chance to play the second one yet, although I've been pretty excited since I saw the first original gameplay trailer from it. The thing I found with the first one is that it felt really short to me. Like, I think I only put 20 hours into the game to finish its first go through, but it was, and I wish there was more of it. And I know there was an expansion pack that I never played, but I am looking forward to picking up two at some point soon. But they're great games. The atmosphere is fantastic. The voice casting is amazing, and it's a really well put together game.
Yeah, I believe there were a couple of DLCs that extended the story in the first one. I haven't played them either. But the second one, although I get the impression that the second one is going to be similarly short, like it's going to be another 20 hours or less. But again, if you play them back to back, they feel just like two parts of a whole, and there you'll get a nice long 40 hours of Dishonored all in a row. And even more if you do like me and plan on doing another playthrough to see all the content with the other character in Dishonored 2. And that is all I've been up to. So now let's get into our discussion of our Pantheon films. As I said at the top, the Pantheon of our films are the movies that we compare all other movies to. They're the movies that just stand out. Like, for example, some of our films include, you know, like The Big Lebowski. We all love The Big Lebowski. And it spans so many genres that it would just pop up again and again. We could talk about, oh, our favorite film noirs, or our favorite murder mysteries, or our favorite comedies, our favorite slacker heroes. All the, so many things could be related back. Our favorite performances from Jeff Bridges or the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, et cetera, et cetera. So we founded the Pantheon to kind of keep those movies out of the way. They're always there. We will always pay tribute to them, but we can't really include them on our lists because we just talk about them all the damn time. And that's what we're going to do right here. We're going to talk about some of our Pantheon films. Before we even get into it, the Pantheon, guys. I mean, we're closing down the Pantheon. We're not going to be adding any new movies to it. What do you think of this aspect of Shouts from the Back Row?
I find it interesting that since we started this podcast, I don't think I've seen any new films within the last 6-7 years that I would add to the Pantheon. I kind of noticed the whole pattern that the Pantheon are ones that we feel nostalgic about, kind of like the movies we grew up with and saw at an early age while we're getting into movies, because I don't think I've seen anything. I've seen a lot of great movies the past several years, but I don't think I've seen anything that I would like add to the Pantheon.
That's fair. That's totally fair. And even films that we did add to the Pantheon, which were inevitably older films, it was a rare occasion. It was sort of like it sort of emerged fully formed, where we instantly knew the films that we wanted in there. Stuff like Star Wars or Indiana Jones, the films that nothing can compare to sort of come easily to mind. That's pretty interesting. I'm now looking at the Pantheon to try and decipher, to try to figure out which is the newest film added to it. And you know what? I found it right here, and it's on TK's list. Birdman is in TK's Pantheon. Care to comment on that?
That movie's incredible, and so many little things I didn't know about it going in. I think that just, I don't know, seeing it in theaters just kind of elevated it to a point that I was going to start comparing films to it to a point that I wasn't going to be able to stop. So it was that's why it went in. It was, God, I love every minute of that movie. It's fantastic.
Fascinating, because I take a stance similar to Robin, where it takes a lot to get into my Pantheon. And time is one of those factors. And for me, it's not a matter of nostalgia. I just kind of feel like you can't truly measure a film's greatness in a year or 2 years. It takes a very long time for a film to really, you know, elevate itself and stand above the rest. Like Shaun of the Dead is 13 years old now. And I definitely include that in the Pantheon. And I guess that means that Hot Fuzz is even more recent. So maybe a decade is about how long it takes to really judge whether a film, in my eyes, is great or not. I don't know.
I think the one exception for you is Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes you just know a masterpiece when you see it. Let's face it, guys. And the funny thing about Mad Max Fury Road is that while it is a very recent film, in a way, it doesn't feel recent because it took so long to arrive. Like, it was so clearly methodically planned out that it was almost like we were seeing through time. But that's sort of another conversation altogether.
Do you know how many times you've seen it since it came out, like within the last 2 years?
Good luck. I've lost count. I studied the hell out of Mad Max Fury Road because it's so tightly put together that I was convinced I could become a better editor if I like studied it frame by frame and took it apart. And I don't know if I became a better editor in doing so, but I certainly discovered a lot of really interesting details that go by so quickly you don't even notice them on a first viewing. So, man, yeah. You're just going to get me gushing on Mad Max Fury Road because I love that movie so much. You're right. That's a recent one for me, but it blew everybody away. So here's the question, guys. We've each got a film to talk about. We each picked a film from our personal Pantheon lists that we want to talk about and discuss with our co-hosts here. TK, you picked Arsenic and Old Lace, the Frank Capra film with Cary Grant. Robin, you chose George Romero's classic Dawn of the Dead. And I picked Tombstone, the Western from 1993, starring Kurt Russell and a cast of mustaches. I gotta ask you guys, why did you choose this film to talk about from your whole Pantheon list? You could have talked about any of these things.
Well, Dawn of the Dead I wanted to choose because George Romero passed away last month, and I'm sure if we had time, we probably would have done an episode about him. But I think it's just so interesting to look back on it just because of how way ahead of its time is, because for the past decade, zombies have become like the in thing in pop culture. Like we know that The Walking Dead, in spite of its major flaws, is still one of the most popular shows on TV. But there wouldn't be A Walking Dead without George Romero or Dawn of the Dead. And at the time it originally came out in 1978, there weren't many zombie movies. Like there was George Romero's Night of the Living Dead and then the sequel. And there's just so much stuff in it that might seem like tired cliches now, but back 1978, it was brand new, so that's why I thought it would be a lot of fun to read.
TK, why did you choose Arsenic and Old Lace?
I've been referencing this movie for almost the whole time we've done this podcast. We've never actually had a formal chance to talk about it. This is an excellent wordplay and physical comedy, and I felt that it's worth watching because you don't see Cary Grant do as much of the physical stuff anymore, and it's kind of fun to watch him like jump around and like be all upright as he like up and down as he is in this film, and there's just some excellent work. As Peter Lorre is good in it, like it's such a fun movie, and I have such a good time seeing it transist from a play which it originally started as to this film and still keeping everything together really well. And I have such a good time with this movie, and it's so funny.
It's a film you love that we've really never discussed on the podcast. It sort of went straight into your Pantheon before it even got on any lists.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I chose Tombstone, which, I mean, I can't help but sort of chuckle as I say it, because this is a nostalgic addition to my Pantheon for me. I saw it in my very early teens, and I just freaking loved it. And this was, at the time when Tombstone came out, this was like the pre-DVD era, when I was like maybe 13 or 14. I guess I would have been 14 when I first saw this film. And so I was watching it on VHS, and we didn't have, you know, Netflix or streaming stuff from the internet. So we were just limited to whatever we had in our collections. My buddy, who I hung out with after school almost every day, had Tombstone on VHS, and we just watched it over and over and over because we thought it was such a damn cool movie. And I thought it would be a good one to talk about because it's like highly relevant to the discussion today. So many of the sort of up and coming stars in this film have become much larger stars. I mean, for crying out loud, Michael Rooker and Kurt Russell were both just in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. They are both in Tombstone. Stephen Lang plays sort of like a B villain in Tombstone, and now, you know, he's known for Avatar and Don't Breathe more recently. And then, of course, there are all the actors in this who have passed away recently, like Bill Paxton, Powers Booth. So I figured it would be just a prime topic of conversation. And it came up a lot recently on a lot of recent episodes, which is why it's in my Pantheon now. But I feel like you guys hadn't really seen it, or you'd seen it a long time ago. Neither of you really had any comments on it. And I've always wanted to know how you feel about Tombstone, because there are certain things about it that I think are truly great, like Val Kilmer's performance as Doc Holliday. But we will get into that. So let's start by really talking about Arsenic and Old Lace. And TK, you gave us like a little intro about why you like it and why you want to talk about it. Did you see the play before you saw the movie?
No, I saw the film first, and then saw it was a play. So found some old recordings of it and watched it from there. Are we gonna start talking about it now? Yes.
Yeah, go for
okay.
it.
Okay. There's one of my favorite running jokes in the film is that Mortimer's brother, Jonathan, shows up, and he's had plastic surgery to change his face. And everybody in the film remarks that he looks like Boris Karloff, and he gets really, really angry. And my favorite tie back to the theater production is that the original role of Jonathan was actually played by Boris Karloff. So I just like that back and forth between the stage and the film production. I just think it's a great movie. God, I don't even know what to start talking. What did you guys think about it? Because I know both of you have seen it, but it's been a really long time. But now that you've had a chance to catch up with it, and like, I'm just curious if you guys like found it as funny as I do, or whether you guys like how did you guys feel about rewatching Arsenic and Old Lace?
Robin, what do you think?
Well, I hadn't seen it in maybe 12, 13 years, and I remember really enjoying it, and I still enjoyed it this time, definitely, because it's what's great about it is that it's really unlike anything else in the filmography of these people. Like, Frank Capra was mostly known for doing movies with big messages. Like, even when he did comedies, there would always be, like, a moral or a comment on society, but this one is just a lighthearted farce, and a really, like, dark one, because it involves, like, sweet old ladies poisoning people and burying the bodies in the basement, that they're just so likable and so casual about it and have this light, fluffy tone. And even though Cary Grant is known for doing a lot of romantic comedies, I've never seen him act this broad before and like deal with like with dark comedy about murdering people and stuff. And I had completely forgotten that Peter Lorre was in this, and the whole gag about the actor Raymond Massey playing a role where he keeps being told he looks like Boris Karloff, even though Boris Karloff played it in the play. So it was a really fun farce. Like, I don't think there's anything really deep and meaningful about it, but it's very witty and very clever, and I kind of like that it never really like sells out or anything, becomes sentimental. It maintains kind of its farcical, absurdly dark tone from beginning to end. And I know that Cary Grant has said that it's one of his least favorite performances because he thought he was too broad in the role because Capra kept telling him to go bigger. But I think he's a blast to watch in this, and it has like perfect I don't think the film would work as well without him, because he's kind of the point of view of the audience where he's like, are you people insane? Why are you acting so casual about murder and stuff? Like, has everyone here lost their mind? So he's kind of the straight man in it, even though he's playing it so broad. And I think he makes it a lot of fun.
I'm just going to interject here. What I kind of enjoy about Grant's performance is that he goes from like wild-eyed, like crazy, like as soon as he finds out what's going on and like confronting his aunts and like trying to talk around the policemen that are coming, and he slowly becomes like more accepting of like the general situation. So first he's like all wide-eyed, and then it just kind of comes into grim acceptance, like, yeah, Teddy's burying people, and like, yeah, my aunts are crazy, and it just like he's kind of just going with the flow with it at that point. It's kind of fun to see him like almost calm down sort of in a way, and then ramp back up right at the end of the film. And like, I don't think anyone else could have done this, because I think they were originally going to get Bob Hope to do it, but they couldn't pull him out of his Paramount contract. So I think I don't know how it would have worked with Hope, but like, Grant is perfect in it.
So confession time, guys. I don't know if I had actually seen this before. I could have sworn I'd seen it, but as I was watching it, it wasn't clicking. So this may well have been the first time I had seen Frank Capra's Arsenic and Old Lace, and I can tell you why that happened. It's because in high school, I performed in a play that was basically an abridged version of Arsenic and Old Lace, and I played Mortimer. So I know this material inside and out, and I kind of feel like maybe I saw parts of it while I was studying up for the play, or maybe I saw it and my memory of the play got sort of muddled into it. But watching this was kind of like a fresh new experience for me. So even though I knew the material, this movie kind of felt like new to me for whatever reason. I don't know if I could have sworn I'd seen it, but for some reason it just didn't click. I quite enjoyed Cary Grant's performance as Mortimer. I say that as a guy who played Mortimer, but it's such a fun role, and you're right. It is like the audience point of view, and the trajectory of that character is like to go really big and over the top and then just get sort of worn down by how everybody treats these things like murder just as the most mundane, normal things. And then, of course, ramping back up as things get crazy nearer to the end. It's super funny. I love a good door-slamming farce. However, I gotta say, I feel like this is a movie best watched with a group of people. Because I don't know about you guys, but I'm less inclined to like laugh out loud if I'm watching a movie solo. I'll laugh, and if sometimes if a movie is extremely funny, I will laugh out loud and like give a hearty belly laugh. But it's not as frequent as when I'm watching it with an audience and everybody can feed off of each other's energy. And so for whatever reason, even though this is a very faithful adaptation, I did not find it as funny as it could have been. And I feel like that's just because I watched it on my own. I didn't watch it with anyone else. But man, it is highly enjoyable. And I feel like this is one of like the true capital C classics among everybody's pantheons. It may be one of the oldest films in anybody's pantheon, and it definitely deserves a place there. But as far as the movie itself goes, though, it really is just sort of a straight adaptation of the play, and I kind of feel like you could watch the movie or you could just watch a stage production of it and get very similar experiences, provided, of course, you do it with an audience that is really energetic and ready to laugh. It's an interesting pick, though, TK. Like, why this and not something like It's a Wonderful Life?
Well, this film was talked up quite a bit by my grandma, and she and I are very close. And so I finally watched it like probably 15 years ago, maybe when I was still at school, and just died laughing. And I brought in a bunch of my friends to show it. I show it to just about everyone. I just think it's such a funny film. And like you were saying, it's a lot of fun to watch with a crowd of people. I think I had 6 to 8 people in my dorm room one night watching this, and we were just howling. And you're right, looking at it, it is kind of like it's a kind of a goofy comedy. And like, there's nothing, like Robin was saying, there's nothing like special or like messagey about it. But I think it's such a well done, quick comedy. Like, I think the language is very fast. I think the diction is quick. I think the script for this is really well done. And I think it's performed in such a fun way, because I think the little old ladies like ham it up just enough. And I think Teddy does like wide-eyed crazy
charge
just well enough. Like whenever he's talking to Mortimer, like and arch his eyebrows and his eyes open up a lot. It just, that makes me laugh so hard.
Yeah, him pulling those faces was definitely one of the highlights for me.
And the policeman who's trying to get Mortimer to read his play because he's an amateur playwright. I just think it's funny. And his fiance who keeps trying to burst in and out, and he keeps on shuffling her outside. And then I don't know. It's such a high spirited film, and I think it has a lot of energy and doesn't make it manic. Like to a point of overblowing it. It's this weird balancing act of action and comedy and mirth. And it's just, it's put together so well by Capra. And that's what I like about it, is that it pushes the boundaries just a little, but not quite. Like, this could have been a really over the top film, but it's played just below that level. And I think that that's what makes it work really well.
Remind me again, TK, have you seen His Girl Friday?
Yes, I have caught up with that. Yes, I have.
Okay, now
you were talking to me about that, and whenever I picked, what did I make you guys watch? That old Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant movie.
Bringing Up Baby,
yeah.
Okay, so I gotta ask, why Arsenic and Old Lace over His Girl Friday, which is my preferred of the two films, and I feel like they're both very similar in a lot of ways. A lot of fast-talking, door-slamming, farcical stuff, both of them based on plays. What do you think?
I think this one is the family connection. I like my grandmother and I watch this a lot and laugh, so it has that slightly higher place in my
nostalgia.
place in my heart for me. Yeah, it's a lot of nostalgia with this film, and that's probably one of the biggest reasons it's on the pantheon for me. But it's just, this is such a personal film to me, and it's one of those old like, well, what's your top five favorite films? Oh no, always, this is always on my list, always. And it's
where would it rank in your top five?
Probably 4, I guess. Yeah. Maybe 3, actually. Maybe. We'll have to see. Okay. I don't know what else I think. Sorry, go ahead.
What other Capra films have you seen, out of curiosity?
This is going to be awful. Hang on a second. Let me bring up the wiki because I feel terrible.
It's Wonderful Life?
Yeah, I've seen Life. I've seen Wonderful Life. Hang on a second. There we go. I've seen Mr. Deeds Go to Town, Mr. Miss Lois Washington, Wonderful Life. I know I've seen more. Sorry, that's all of his.
I have honestly seen only three of his films. It's Wonderful Life, this film, and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Actually, hang on a second. I've seen a bunch of these. Sorry, as I'm going through the list. American Madman I've seen, Mr. Deeds, Can't Take a Myth we have seen. I've seen a lot of these.
How do you think, do you feel, Robin was saying this kind of stands out in his filmography because it's not one of his, like, message films. What do you think of that?
I think if you look at the films he's doing around it, he was doing a bunch of war propaganda, and I think it's kind of this was made in 1944, right? So the war was still going, and I think it was kind of I just need to make something fun. At this point, maybe he got tired of doing the message stuff over and over, but that's the interpretation I'll take from it.
And now we finally got a chance to talk about it. Arsenic and Old Lace.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. It was fun. Oh, the film—it was actually filmed in 1941. Cool. Right.
Yeah, I find that neat that it was on the shelf for 3 years before it was released. That's usually a really bad sign, but not for this movie.
No, not at all. And what I like that a lot of people from the play went on to be in the film, like the answer from the play, Teddy's from the play. I just think that's nice that they were able to wrap that, because you don't see that happen as often. I think it's something I would like to see happen more often in films.
I wish they had gotten Karloff to play Jonathan.
Oh, yeah, that, because the joke would have gone over way better. But I even kind of like how they make up Massey in that. I think it's well done. He looks grim, which I like.
So, sorry, go ahead, Robin.
I was saying, I think it's only appropriate that you chose this because that's kind of in the recurring theme of the podcast, that you would always choose the older movies for us to see.
It's true. And Robin, you usually pick something from the 70s or 80s, and I usually pick something more modern, and look at what happened. We did it again, guys. We are nothing.
What a surprise. I am shocked. Shocked and appalled.
So I was going to segue there, though, and say, Frankenstein, Karloff, and Jonathan looks like Frankenstein's monster, a walking corpse. And hey, speaking of walking corpses, let's talk about George Romero's Dawn of the Dead. And Robin, you gave us a bit of an introduction. This is, of course, like the classic groundbreaking zombie movie from George Romero, the follow-up to Night of the Living Dead. And, of course, George Romero passed away recently as well, so it's worth talking about. This is also a film that was remade by Zack Snyder and kind of launched his career, and also gave James Gunn's career a real boost. Of course, yet another connection to something, to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, now that I think about it. But what else about Dawn of the Dead stands out to you, Robin? Why is this in your pantheon?
Well, it just blew me away when I first saw it as a teenager in high school. I remember I saw Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead in the same week together, like back to back. And I know Dawn, it was like long out of print by then. So I remember renting this like ragged old VHS tape from Blockbuster. And it was so cool just to see them like for the first time back to back, just because like Night of the Living Dead is smaller and more intimate, set on a farmhouse, just as this zombie epidemic is breaking out. And then Dawn shows the aftermath. How it's pretty much taken over the world and civilization is crumbling. It has a pretty brilliant premise about how these four characters all try to survive together by barricading themselves in a shopping mall. And this was way back when shopping malls were like a still relatively new phenomenon. So it was pretty satirical, like showing zombies walking around aimlessly through the mall while this Muzak is playing, this like lighthearted music over these horrific themes, making kind of a none too subtle social commentary. But what I found really interesting is like the first two-thirds of the movie are them killing off the zombies and trying to clear them out and build up this utopia. And then there's this stretch of maybe 20, 25 minutes where the zombies are completely forgotten about off-screen, where you don't see them at all. You just see the four characters as they're trying to adapt to this new life trapped inside a mall. And you see them kind of slowly going insane, where it's like they've got this paradise, but now they're getting bored and just getting frustrated because they can't go outside. They have to live in this world of commercialism. And I know this is the kind of material like on The Walking Dead, which pretty much killed it, where they would stay away from the zombies and focus on the human squabbles, and it would just get really, really tedious, and you just get really bored. But in Dawn, it's just fascinating because they had never really done this before. It was like a zombie film where they focused on the decline of the humans and how it related to them, and then it has the big ironic twist in the last act where the whole thing is shattered by this biker gang who breaks into the mall, and the zombies are almost secondary because it becomes a war between the heroes and the bikers, and the zombies are just kind of props in the middle. And I know at the time, this was the goriest movie I had ever seen. Like, if you watch it today, it seems kind of tame, but when they showed scenes where, like, the zombies are eating the bikers' intestines while they're still alive, I had never seen anything like that in a film before, and I was just kind of horrified by it. And I also love the way they kind of pulled the rug out from the audience at the end, because Night of the Living Dead had the ultimate feel-bad ending where, like, all the main characters were killed, and it looks like they're going to set up in that direction where the main character Peter is going to commit suicide, but then it has this sudden inspirational ending where they play this upbeat music where he decides he wants to survive and kills the zombies and then escapes out in the helicopter in this upbeat ending. And I thought it was really cool like that. I've never really, at the time, had never seen a horror film like it. But of course, now zombie movies are like a dime a dozen. Like, they've done so many movies like that have been inspired by the original Dawn of the Dead. I thought it was hilarious that the remake of Dawn of the Dead and the satire Shaun of the Dead came out in the exact same year. And it was kind of surreal because in the 90s, when I watched this movie originally, nobody I knew had heard of this movie, Dawn of the Dead. And I tried to get people to watch it, but I couldn't get to succeed. But then when the remake came out and Shaun of the Dead came out, everybody had heard of Dawn of the Dead. And then we got so many zombie movies coming out after that. And we had The Walking Dead, and zombies became pretty much the thing in pop culture. But Dawn of the Dead, the original, was pretty much the one who launched it. And I know some people who have watched it for the first time in the modern era after seeing so many zombie movies, and they don't really find the original film that impressive, probably because it has so many cliches that the movie invented that are such standard tropes in zombie movies right now. But at the time, it was new and fresh and had just blew me away. And that's why it's kind of interesting to revisit it, just to see how much it holds up compared to the zombie movies of now. But I still think the original Dawn of the Dead is the king and the best zombie movie ever made. And there's just so much in pop culture today that wouldn't be around right now if it wasn't for Dawn of the Dead.
Absolutely. And I had a sort of similar experience to you, where I feel like no matter when you're born, when you're like 13, 12, 13, 14, and a burgeoning horror movie fan, that is around the time where you discover the, you know, blank of the dead movies from George Romero. Because it was when I was like 13 years old that I saw Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead, all very close together. And I had a similar experience to you. Couldn't find a DVD, so I had to rent this battered cassette tape from Blockbuster Video. And incidentally, the cassette for Day of the Dead that I rented and I saw Day of the Dead for the first time on was a censored cut, where it cut out some of the really gory money shots. It was kind of terrible. But this was a great excuse for me to rewatch Dawn of the Dead after having not seen it for a number of years now. And something that struck me that I'd never really noticed before, but I really appreciated this time, is the characters are smart. Like, they make smart choices. They make choices that you feel you yourself would make in a zombie apocalypse, because we've all played that mind game, right? Where you think, what would I do in a zombie apocalypse? And I almost feel like the script for Dawn of the Dead was constructed with that in mind, because it seems to have a lot, a progression that is very much, okay, and then what? where it's like, okay, so what would you do? I'd get, if you were working at a TV station during the zombie apocalypse, what would you do? Oh, I'd steal the weather helicopter. Okay, but where would you go? I'd go to a shopping mall. What would you do once you were there? Well, first I'd kill all the zombies inside. And then what? Well, then I'd barricade the doors. Well, how would you do that? You know, like, it's a series of questions that, and you're sort of figuring out the answers along with the characters, and you're watching them make those decisions as you sort of answer those questions in your head as you watch. And the film does take its time in showing us all the steps, you know? Like, it would be very easy for the movie to be like, okay, so they barricade the doors by parking these shipping trucks in front of them. And, you know, you can do that in a couple of cuts, and then they've done it. But no, they show, you know, the characters, they go out, they find the right trucks, they make sure they have the keys, they park one truck, and then they have to go back and do another one, and they're doing it step by step, and we're along for the ride, watching them, you know, do this lengthy procedure, and the longer we follow them, the more danger they get in, and the more zombies there are, and you start to realize, like, everything they do in this world has the potential for death. So I really appreciated how the film progressed, how it wasn't afraid to take its time in showing us, you know, how these characters would have to do these things and all the different steps that they take to accomplish these goals. And I really do love that they're smart characters. They make decisions that you feel you would make. So yeah, this is a zombie classic, you know. It may not be in my personal pantheon, but it is an outstanding film that the entire zombie genre of horror owes fealty to. TK, had you seen Dawn of the Dead before this?
So I saw the remake before I saw the original. So I saw the 2004 version, which I really liked. I really, really enjoyed. And then going back and watched the original one, I think because... I'm going to be honest. Between the two, I can appreciate the one made in the late 70s, but I kind of enjoy the remake a little bit more.
No, blasphemy right there, man.
Blasphemy, I know. And then Robin never talked to him again.
Actually, your reaction is not that much different than most people I knew. Like, they saw the remake first when it came out and then went back and watched the original, and most people I know preferred the remake because they saw it first. And it is does have some logic, that decision.
Oh, and I'm sure that if I'd seen it the other way, I'd appreciate it a lot more. But what's really funny is that I actually saw the because the ending is different, or it was supposed to be changed, right? Because the main guy is supposed to die in the room, and the helicopter is supposed to take off with just the girl in it. From what I understand, when Romero's original thing.
No, she cuts her own head off in the propeller right, blades.
That's right. And I always thought that that would have made the ending a lot more dramatic. But like you were saying, Gil, it's kind of funny. I went through whenever I saw Night of the Living Dead, I went out and watched all of them. Like I went out and watched the other of the dead films. Like that's your discovery period, right? And like I really enjoyed this one. I like number three a little bit more, like a little bit than the original. It was fun anyway. I think this film this is a big commentary film, and it's one of Romero's, I think, most in-your-face ones, because of the consumerism, and they all party out as soon as they feel they're safe, and then they I don't want to say they forget about anything, but it's an interesting commentary stuff, and I think Romero was really good at it, and I think the combination with the zombies and the consumerism, I think, is a pretty powerful message to the end of it.
I love how, like, gonzo this film feels. Like, it really feels like a cheap independent movie because, like, things look dangerous. The stunts look really dangerous and unsafe and unsupervised. And I love that it takes place in this bizarre shopping mall. Like, guys, have you ever been in a shopping mall that is at all like the one in Dawn of the Dead? It is so weird.
I love how they have, like, this hunting store with all these guns inside. It's like, I have never been to a shopping mall with a gun store, as far as I know.
And just, like, these strange animatronic displays. It is a bizarre mall, but I guess it was a real place, because they shot it in a mall. And I love seeing characters doing sort of what you always fantasize about doing in like a big box store where you can just take anything and you can, you know, smash all the cases and throw stuff around. It's got an element of sort of rebellious glee to it. Like, it's a very sort of rascally movie where it's like, oh, look at what we're doing. We're going to smash up all the merchandise, and then the zombies are going to come in and we're going to have a pie fight with the zombies and the bikers. And look, Tom Savini's going to see that walkway over there? Tom Savini's going to jump off that. Can you believe it? Like, it really feels sort of like fun and devil may care. And I think that's part of the appeal of it for me as well, is while you watch it, like, you kind of feel like, oh, this is great. Like, look at what they're doing. They're really trashing this mall.
And yeah, like, watching it, it's like, oh, that would be really cool, like, having your own shopping mall for a period. But then it shows, like, the other side to it, that if you live in here for a long period of time, you're probably going to go nuts.
Oh, and the score, man, the score by Goblin and Dario Argento. Can't go unmentioned. Robin, what do you think of the remake?
Well, I actually do like the remake. Like, I think it's a good model of how you should do one, because all it really takes is the premise, like the whole thing about people barricading themselves in a shopping mall in a zombie epidemic, but it's totally different. Like, it doesn't just rehash the same scenes with the same characters. Like, here you had four characters, whereas in the remake you have a whole bunch of them, and they have like a whole bunch of new twists, like the zombie baby and stuff like that, and and it updates the story very well, like shows how society would function in a modern day shopping mall rather than the 70s one. So I thought they did a really good job with it, but of course my fondness is still going to be with the original because it paved the way.
Yeah, I really dig the remake of Dawn of the Dead as well. And I mean, with James Gunn writing it, I can see why. And Zack Snyder, I feel like Zack Snyder's quality has gone down over the years, but this first film, it still had a bit of edge to it. He still made some cool choices, like the opening credits montage set to Johnny Cash. I think it was a very inspired choice. So, yeah, I like the remake as well. But, I mean, the original, you just can't beat the original. The original has Tom Savini in it. I mean, let's face it. And Ken Foree. These are the reasons. It's got that zombie who gets the top of his head cut off by a helicopter. I love
yes.
that.
No, Ken Foree remains one of my favorite horror movie characters of all time, because Peter is such a badass and he's smart, and he's kind of like the glue that holds the movie together. And I kind of like how Ken Foree is still getting roles in horror movies today because of that. Remember when we went to the Mayfair and saw that awful zombie movie called Zone of the Dead? I think it was from Bulgaria or something like that, and he was pretty
terrible.
Much playing the exact same character, but it just shows the lasting effect that his performance has had on the genre.
Yeah, he is totally a cult icon because of this movie. Really terrific. Okay, guys, and that brings us to Tombstone, and I'm so curious to hear your thoughts on Tombstone. Like I said, you know, this movie is a nostalgic pick for me. I think it is one of Val Kilmer's absolute best performances as Doc Holliday, especially when I was first watching it when I was like 14 years old. I just thought he was the king of cool in this movie. This gentleman, poet, gambler, gunslinger. He's just so damn cool. Also, the all-star cast is packed with big names. I talked about people like Michael Rooker, you know, who has gone on to, he's on bags of Doritos now, that guy, he's so famous. But also people like Harry Connick Jr. has a small role, and it's interesting to see him go on to bigger things. Billy Zane has a bit part in this. Charlton Heston shows up just like for a couple of scenes, or like a scene and a half. It really is full of big names. I like the portrayals of all the characters. I feel like this film is trying to evoke a very specific period in Western movie history, which is the sort of sweeping Technicolor Western, something maybe like Rio Bravo or How the West Was Won, because there's some over-the-top melodramatic stuff in Tombstone that would totally be at home in one of those very, those like old golden age of cinema Westerns. Something I also appreciate about this is I've done some reading up on it, and apparently this is a really historically accurate depiction of, like, the legend of Wyatt Earp. You know, there are a few changes that they obviously made. Apparently, Ike Clanton was the leader of the Cowboys, not Curly Bill. And Ike was smart, whereas in the movie he's dumb. But things like Curly Bill meeting his end, being shot to death by Wyatt Earp in a river, or Johnny Ringo dying because of a bullet to the head, though it may have been suicide, historical records are unclear. A lot of the details are accurate to history, which I also appreciated. And apparently all the mustaches are authentic. You gotta love the facial hair in this movie. I think there's just so much to appreciate about it. So I turn it over to you guys. Maybe a good question is, had you seen it before?
Oh, yes, but not for a long, long time. That's why when we talked about it on previous podcasts, I was trying to jar my memory, trying to think, what did I think of this film? How well do I remember it? But I didn't, so it was good to revisit it.
TK, had you seen it prior to this?
Yeah, I had. Only a couple years ago. But it was fun to go back and revisit. Oh my god, I forgot the mustaches. I forgot how
how mustachey everywhere. The movie is. Well, what did you think? What do you think of this as a Western, as a Kurt Russell movie? What do you think of the late Bill Paxton's performance in it?
Well, I should love this movie, but rewatching it, I do think it's a bit of a mess overall. And I think it has too much material and too many characters who don't get as much screen time as they should have. I've heard rumors that there was original rough cut of this that was like 3 hours long. And I think it could have shed more light on this story and made it the epic it's intending to be, because it does feel kind of choppy at times. Like, this movie has an amazing cast, but you see so many like great actors popping up in like small supporting roles where you want to see more of them, and then they just kind of disappear from the movie for a while. It has really great performances, really entertaining characters, but I think this movie might have benefited from a better director, because for years I couldn't even remember who directed this, and then I looked it up and I saw George P. Cosmatos. What did he do again? And I'm like, oh, he did Rambo First Blood Part 2 and Cobra. So he's not exactly a great director. Like, I find that some of his shootouts in this are kind of choppy. I think the gunfight at the OK Corral is pretty great, but the problem is that the movie drags on for like another hour after that, and I kind of feel that the climactic gunfights are kind of like anticlimactic and disappointing, and that the movie should have handled them like a lot better. So it's an enjoyable movie to watch, but when you look at the cast and you look at the performances and the source of the material, you kind of get the sense that it could have been a lot better. That's kind of my opinion, at least. That I actually have talked about this before, that the Kevin Costner movie Wyatt Earp, which was a major flop when it came out, and I don't think it's a great movie. I think it's flawed, but I kind of think it handled this material a little better because it was 3 hours long, and I think it got the epic scope of this story a lot better and developed the characters a little better. So when you can combine the two, when you combine Tombstone and Wyatt Earp, it's kind of like there's almost like one great movie about this story if you combine them, just waiting to break out. But in the end, I think it's like two separate flawed movies on their own, which have good parts but are not great overall.
So, fun fact about the director, apparently George, is it Cosmatos. Apparently he was terrible, and Kurt Russell ghost directed most of this movie.
Oh, wow.
It was actually confirmed recently on Reddit by Val Kilmer himself. As a like a tangent here, Val Kilmer is a really active Redditor. He has his own Reddit account that's just official Val Kilmer, and he loves just hanging out. He does AMAs like on a whim. He responds to people's comments and posts like behind the scenes footage and stuff. And not that long ago, he officially confirmed what had been a rumor for years, which is that Kurt Russell actually directed most of Tombstone. But that might also explain why you felt it was sort of disjointed and choppy, because I don't think Kurt Russell is an especially experienced director.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Also, what you were saying about the side characters that you wish you'd seen more of, you know, I kind of feel like maybe the fact that I watched it so many times filled that in for me, because then I get to know those side characters even in their short little scenes, and they don't feel as those roles don't feel as small after you watch it, you know, four times. TK, what do you think?
It's kind of funny. I looked on.
Go ahead.
I was saying, it's kind of funny because I looked on Wikipedia, like, of the summary of the movie afterwards, and I see, like, all these biographies for these characters who were only on screen for, like, a couple minutes, and that kind of filled me in on their backstory, and I kept thinking, oh, I would have loved to have seen more of these guys, like Charlton Heston's character, Henry Hooker, who's on screen for, like, a minute or so. Like, he seemed like a really interesting guy, so I wanted to learn more about him in the movie.
TK, what did you think of Tombstone?
It's Tombstone. Like, I think I like your comparison earlier about it being like a Technicolor Western, like a big loud kind of fun, not fun, I should say. That's
well,
not really.
It's got that sweeping score. It has,
yeah,
you know, that saturated color. It has, you know, some deaths are in slow motion, which is a very sort of old melodramatic flourish. It also has the best no in all of cinema.
I can appreciate like the way it's put together. Like I'm with Rob, and there are some of the fight scenes, the gun scenes in this are a little choppy, and there is some dialogue in this film that I just can't get around.
Really,
my favorite is "Shut your mouth, or I'll turn your head into a canoe." What does that
mean? It means he's going to carve a groove through the top of his head with a bullet. I think
it's just like okay, so like I just said that line and you both just busted a gut laughing. Like,
I gotta fight you on this, man. I think the dialogue in this film is stellar. I think it's corny as hell, but I think like everything that Doc Holliday says is brilliant. You know, it's a nocturne. You know, Friedrich fucking Chopin. Things like that. Really quite brilliant, but it is undeniably cheesy.
It's cheesy, and I don't know. Sometimes I can't pull my head out of cheesy to appreciate it, and I guess that's what I don't know. I guess that's the mindset I was in when I rewatched it recently. I like Sam Elliott in this. I love Bill Paxton just about everything, and he's fun in this movie.
What do you guys think of Bill Paxton? This is, I mean, I mentioned it on our tribute podcast to him after he passed away as one of my favorite Bill Paxton roles. What did you guys think of him in this?
Oh, he was great in it. Like, I had no complaints about Paxton. Like, that's like the ultimate dream team. Like, Kurt Russell, Sam Elliott, and Bill Paxton teaming up together. So, I mean,
well,
yeah,
to do cowboys too. It's so perfect for the material.
Exactly, like with mustaches all together. Like, I'd love to see like the Earps in another movie, almost like just seeing some of their adventures together. But the casting in this movie was perfect. I'll give it that.
Yeah, I really love that. You know, we've seen tough Bill Paxton, we've seen scary Bill Paxton, we've seen chicken shit Hudson Bill Paxton, but it's not often you see, like, boyish, happy-go-lucky Bill Paxton. I really love sort of how Morgan is, like, the gee whiz, you know? Aw, gee whiz, guys. We're going to be so happy here. Which, of course, makes him meeting his end all the more tragic. TK, what did you think of Bill Paxton in it?
I love Paxton, and just after him passing on, I think you can just come to appreciate him so much more in the roles because you like seeing him. And like he's like, I like that. The oh gosh, it's that's pretty much him in this
Well, it's interesting. You know, Sam Elliott is just like born to play a cowboy, but it's brilliant casting to have Bill Paxton and Kurt Russell playing brothers, in my opinion, because I feel like they make a really good brotherly duo. And they have just like enough of a passing resemblance that you'd believe it. What did you guys think? Go ahead.
And of course, when we were talking about cheesy dialogue, we have to mention the cheesiest no in cinematic history. No!
No! No! Oh, I mean, you can't help but smile, though. You can't help but smile. There was another actor who passed away, Powers Booth. What did you think of Powers Booth in this, guys?
Oh, I liked him at all. His best moment is his sarcastic "bah." That moment is just brilliant.
I'm just gonna jump in here and like going through the cast list, and like as I was rewatching it, I forgot so many other people were in this. Like Terry O'Quinn's in this, mm-hmm. Billy Zane is in this, Billy
like
Bob Thornton
fat,
is in this,
fat
Michael,
Billy Bob Thornton.
Michael Rooker is in this. It's great. It's so fun to just like I forgot about half these people that were in the film. It's like Jason Priestley is in this, like because of course he's in this. But like oh god, the cast is fantastic. Just alone, it's great.
Yeah, what did you think of Fat Billy Bob Thornton? I did not realize immediately that that was Billy Bob Thornton. When I remember, it took a couple of watches way back when for me to finally go like, oh, wait a minute. That's that guy.
Well, remember on my Paxton podcast, I was talking about that underrated movie him and Bill Paxton did together called One False Move, where Thornton played the villain in it and wrote the screenplay for it. And that came out the year before Tombstone. And Thornton, I think, was still a relative unknown. So I have to wonder if Paxton helped him get the role in the movie since they had previously worked together. And of course, they would work together like so often afterwards in movies like Simple Plan. So it's kind of neat to see like Thornton in this movie where he's made some acclaimed movies, but he's still a relative unknown. So it's kind of cool to see him pop up in that small role.
Oh, forgive me, Johnny. I forgot you were there. You may go. So I keep talking about Val Kilmer, guys. We got to touch on Val Kilmer as Doc Holliday. Like, I really do feel like this is Kilmer's best performance, and like to the point where maybe he was snubbed a Best Supporting Actor nomination at the Oscars, because for all that the movie is corny and maybe a little disjointed, I really think that he is just such a standout in this film. He's so dapper and so darn cool, and a total badass. Like, he manages to make things like saying "I'm your Huckleberry" into like a really threatening phrase. What do you guys think of Val Kilmer?
Oh, yeah, he's great. Like, I remember when this movie came out, there was a lot of buzz about his performance and how he's totally stole the movie. I actually remember hearing about how Siskel and Ebert, how this was actually a movie that was not screened for critics. And so it didn't get a lot of reviews ahead of time. And Siskel and Ebert didn't think they would see it. They're thinking, oh, if they don't screen it for the critics, the movie's going to be a disaster. But then they kept hearing so much buzz about Val Kilmer's performance that they decided to watch it. And I think Siskel gave it a thumbs down, but Ebert liked it and praised his performance and said, wow, this movie was better than expected. And it was kind of like, I think his performance helped give this movie a lot more buzz than it otherwise would have gotten when it came out.
TK, of all people, I feel like you would most appreciate Doc Holliday in this film.
I'll be your Huckleberry. Yeah, it's, I don't know, the idea of this, like, sick gunslinger is super cool to me, and like I don't know who else could have played it as well as Kilmer did. I like the makeup they have on him. I like his diction. I like the way he says everything. It was a lot of fun revisiting. I just found myself like smiling at a lot of his dialogue, and it was he's a treat to watch in this. He really is, my goodness.
Yeah, just the way he plays with Johnny Ringo. You know, Ringo shows off his gun spinning skills, and Doc responds by twirling around a shot glass on his finger. Just, you know, those little touches are really clever and funny. He gets all the best lines, and he looks great in all of his costumes. This is ultimately, it's the Doc Holliday show. It really is his movie, even though it's about the Earps. And man, I can't get enough of it. Definitely also, my favorite Val Kilmer.
Also, Robert Mitchum narrates this, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Is like it. This is just a who's who of great actors, and even if they're on screen just for a tiny little bit, it's still a real treat to see them. And it is amazing looking at it now, so many years later, and seeing sort of what has happened. We've had some actors pass on. So many of these actors have gone on to huge things, and we're still like seeing them in big summer movies. It's really cool. It's kind of an unusual time capsule, especially someone like Billy Bob Thornton, where this was really before he found fame, but now he is very famous and so much thinner than he is in this film. I really can't get over how unlike himself he looks with that extra weight and that beard. You can only really tell by the eyes and the voice. Well, guys, any final thoughts on the Pantheon before we sort of close the doors on these dusty halls of cinema?
I don't suppose you've ever rewatched one of your movies in the Pantheon and wondered and thought it didn't belong there anymore. Like, are there any in your Pantheon that you've ever felt don't hold up, or are they just cross that line where they can do no wrong?
There is. Let me just see here. There is. And, you know, here's my confession to make. I removed it. As soon as I was, like, one day I was looking over my list again and I saw it. I can't remember what it was, but I was like, that doesn't deserve to be on there. And I just took it off quietly without making an announcement about it. And now whatever it is gone. And the fact that I can't remember it sort of proves my own point. So I know I've done it once. I know okay. I've kind of, my opinion of one of these movies has definitely gone down.
Interesting. Now I'm curious to know which one it is, but you can't remember it.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious as well. And looking at it now, if I had to pick a movie to remove from my pantheon, I think it would actually be Grindhouse. Because while I do love Grindhouse, in the end, what I loved most about it was the experience of seeing Grindhouse in a movie theater. And I don't actually revisit those films very often on their own on the small screen. It was the full experience that made me love it so much. What about you guys?
Yeah, that's a valid point. I don't think there's anything I would take off. No, like I mean, there's some where I'm thinking, well, maybe I would substitute one for the other, but I can't think of anywhere I've rewatched them and thought, oh, what the hell was I thinking on this one?
Interesting. Would you? I'm looking at your list here. Would you still keep Inglourious Basterds on here?
I think so, because that's when I've rewatched and just gets better and better with every viewing. I actually would have the same feeling about Grindhouse, where I would have been tempted to put it on there, and it's still a lot of fun to watch, but like the experience itself kind of dwarfs the movie, where it's still a lot of fun to watch on the small screen, but seeing it on the big screen is what made it so special the first time around, whereas Inglourious Basterds, every time I rewatch it on the small screen, it's still as great as it was, so I don't think I would remove it at all.
And what about you, TK? Is this where you confess that you're taking The Big Lebowski out of your pantheon?
What? Like, what? No, I wouldn't take anything out of this, I don't think, going down the whole thing. No, not a damn thing. Actually, it makes me want to rewatch a few of them. I haven't seen Vertigo in a number of years.
There you go. I mean, ultimately, the point of the Pantheon is this is a selection of movies that we would watch happily at any time. And I feel totally confident in saying, you know, after we're done recording this podcast, I would gladly watch any one of the movies, frankly, on any of our lists. Even films, like, I'm not the biggest fan of Magnolia, for example, which is on Robin's Pantheon list, but I haven't seen it in a long time. I would absolutely give it a watch. I'd be happy to watch any of these films. And so I guess that brings our discussion. Actually, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Actually, looking over my list, there's only one Wes Anderson film on this.
Shocking.
It is shocking. Yeah. I would put Grand Budapest on there, I think. Huh.
All right, Grand Budapest. It's been added at the last minute. We're just bringing it in under the wire.
Maybe you were being like kind and saying, oh, I only have to limit myself to only one Wes Anderson one. But there's no rules. It's your pantheon.
No, I don't. All of them go on the pantheon.
Every single one. Well, that brings us to the end of our discussion of the pantheon of Shouts from the Back Row. The best films, the films that we compared all the other films we have seen to. Man, pretty darn cool. And you know what that means. Now we're going to play the Ticket Price is Right, the box office prediction game, where we try to predict the opening weekend box office grosses of movies being released this week, and we also look back on our last predictions. Last time, we were predicting the opening totals for three movies. First up, Annabelle Creation, which I've heard, like, really good reviews about. Robin, you haven't seen this yet, huh?
No, I haven't. I remember finally watching the original Annabelle a couple years ago and was totally bored by it. But I hear this one is better, surprisingly.
Yeah, it seems like this is going to be one of those Ouija Origin of Evil situations where the sequel is much better than it has any right to be. Anyway, I won that one. It made $35 million. I said it would make $30 million with the high bid. And I'm probably going to watch this. The Glass Castle was our next movie we were predicting for, and I won again, this time with the low bid. I said it would make $5 million. It made $4.6 million. Didn't do those book numbers, TK. I hear it's not
the
best movie, though.
Actually, shocked.
And then finally, the Nut Job 2, Nutty by Nature. Robin, you took this one. You said it would make $10 million. It made $8 million. So Robin is evidently the biggest fan of the Nut Job among all of us.
I was responsible for most of that box office tally. I saw it multiple times this week.
You saw it so many times.
Yeah.
This week, we're predicting the opening totals for two movies. First up is The Hitman's Bodyguard, the Ryan Reynolds, Samuel L. Jackson buddy movie. It was made on a budget of $30 million, and TK, you get to go first.
Let's go 20 and see how that works.
$20 million. I'm going to go lower. I'm going to say $15 million. And Robin, how much do you think The Hitman's Bodyguard is going to make?
I'm going to go in between, because there's not a lot of buzz surrounding it. I'll go with 17.
$17 million. And then next up is Logan Lucky. And TK, I'm willing to bet you're excited for this movie, right?
Oh my god, I want to see it so bad. it's a Soderbergh heist movie with a character named Joe Bang with an exclamation mark. I can't wait.
It certainly looks like Daniel Craig's most interesting performance in years. It has a budget of $29 million, has a budget $1 million less than The Hitman's Bodyguard. And TK, how much will Logan Lucky make opening weekend?
25.
I'm saying much lower. I think this is going to get great reviews, but I think it's only going to make $10 million. And Robin, what do you think?
I'll do the same as my last one. I'll go with $17 million again.
$17 million. And I should read out the new scores since we are approaching the end of the Ticket Prices Right. TK is still in the lead with 12 points, but I'm catching up with 10, and Robin is way back in behind with 7. So it could be anybody's game at this point. We're going to have a surprise Robin win from behind at the last minute.
Yeah.
Now it's time for the dumb joke of the week. I just found out that the local barber was arrested for selling drugs. I can't believe it. I was a customer of his for years, and I had no idea he cut hair.
Oh, man.
You know, that one's better than you guys give it credit for. That's a better joke than you think. If you want to get in touch with us, well, that's just too darn bad. You could probably find us some way, though. If you go to the-back-row.com, you can find all of our writing, links to so many projects that we're involved in, a link to my video editing portfolio at mcgillfoot.com, and of course, Robin's amazing, popular, famous podcast project, The Trail Went Cold, where he examines a new true crime cold case every Wednesday. Join the Facebook discussion group for extra true crime discussion, and you too can interact with the host, Robin Werder, but you may have to pay if you want to get him on Skype.
And people, I love the reaction people make when they were like, oh my god, Robin Werder officially, personally approved my request to join the group. And it's like, well, yeah, it's my group.
Yeah. It is one of those things where it's sort of like, well, who the hell am I? Like,
exactly.
No, man.
I don't have an entourage Robin Werder request. Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.